Hi guys.
The truth is, it's going up like this. Like, I don't care. This is how it's going up. You guys are just going to receive it like this. This is how you're going to take me. Hi everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Things You Can't Touch. Today's episode is, I think it's very special because I have a special guest and I'm going to allow him to introduce himself in a moment. But for everyone who is new to the channel, make sure you subscribe and things of that nature. Everyone who's been here before, welcome back, and I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Hello
everyone. Thank you for having me on, Eden. No grateful problem. To be here.
Thank you for coming.
My name is Riyad Haseeb. I have a TikTok account called The Lyceum of Arts, where I talk about philosophy, literature, paintings, the whole range of things that make you think and appreciate life in a much more in-depth way. And I'm a man who just loves to share beautiful knowledge, ideas to, I don't know, inspire people and, you know, push them into the world of philosophy. I guess that's the best way to put it. I came across Eden's content on TikTok when she was talking about Schopenhauer, and it really piqued my interest. So I'm here today and I'm grateful to be here. I said that already, but I'm excited for the episode to go.
Like, I'm just so happy that you're here. Oh my gosh. Guys, make sure you run up his socials, by the way. I'm going to put it up there and you're going to follow. Check out his account. It's really, really cool, which is why he's here, because only cool kids allowed. The things you can't touch. Right. Your question. I feel like I should just go straight in and just ask you. It's about time. Like, the suspense.
By the way, she's been telling me about this question for a week. So I don't know what the question is. And all week, I've been trying to work out, okay, what could she ask me? How do I even think about this? But yeah, I'm all yours. I'm excited.
When I ask you the question, please can you tell me if, like, you expected it?
Okay, of course. Before you answer. I'm an honest man.
No, this time I actually want to know.
I'll tell you.
So here's the question. No, imagine if it's, like, really bad. Like,
you just want to build suspense, don't you?
Yes, I'm thinking, imagine. Like, it's actually just a terrible question.
No, it's not.
Okay, cool. No, I'm just asking.
All questions must have answers.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So you better be able to answer this one.
Well, you better be able to ask me the question.
Okay,
then.
No, you're right. Okay, cool. Should we fear death?
Wow. First of all, I didn't expect that question.
Really?
No. I thought it was going to ask me something about, like, Schopenhauer, you know?
Yeah, fairs. Because that's how you found me in it. It was too typical.
There's only... I can answer the question briefly, and then we can see where we go.
I have different places that I want to take it.
I think you should fear death as a means of urgency for your own life. Mm.
As a means of urgency.
Yeah, well...
Let me let you land. Go on.
So I can only speak about myself, and then I can anecdotal, then I can relate it. Mm-hmm. Then we can take it into its abstract.
Yeah.
For me personally, death is something I've always struggled with. The concept of, you know, one day you can die.
Mm-hmm.
And the hardest thing for your imagination to conceive is your own death.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the only way I've never overcome my fear of death. I've only put it at bay by trying to achieve great things. So when my death eventually comes, I've left enough material and enough of my own name and legacy that can make my mum proud.
Mm-hmm.
Because my mum, she raised me hard. She put a lot of hard work in.
Mm-hmm.
She had to go through a lot of struggles. And the way I want to repay her is by doing something great with my life. And
very quickly.
Yeah.
Can I talk about that?
Yeah, of course. Open to anything.
People say that all the time. Like, you know, even... Have you watched Hamilton?
No,
you
don't have to. Hamilton.
Okay, because even, like, I feel like the central focus and the central question in Hamilton is who lives, who dies, who writes your story.
That's a nice one.
Who's going to tell your story when you're gone?
Absolutely.
And what's going to happen to your story when you're gone? But I just feel like, why? Why do you need to make a mark? Why do you need to make an impact?
Well, because one thing so when it comes to ideals, we believe we choose our own ideals.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your ideals choose you. And me growing up, I always used to love the in history,
mm-hmm.
where you see, like, Caesar, Napoleon, Shakespeare. Yeah. And these guys had one life, one mm-hmm. simple life. Some lasted 50 years or 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how long human nature has been, over 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And some human beings, individuals, have lived lives at 50 to 80 years, and they're remembered for the rest of history.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that's a good ambition to have for my sake. And one idea, so when it comes to the ideals that I believe chose me, is that I was always inspired that a person in their individual life was able to give a big enough impact that inspires the next generations on. And it's just something that chose me. I've always been inspired by that.
Okay.
For example, Shakespeare, 1500s in England.
So do you think that chose him?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
what do you think? Because I'm struggling. I don't know. I don't know if I completely. I hear where you're coming from, but I don't know if I completely agree with the notion that it just chooses you. I think sometimes in this life, some people work really hard for the things that they end up achieving. But I feel like even within that, I see where you're coming from. In that.
Let me ask you a question. Do you believe in destiny or fate?
Ooh.
Do you think everyone has a destiny? Or do you have ever had that feeling in your life, a sense of destiny, where mm-hmm. you kind of look into the sky or you look back on your life and you imagine yourself and you're like, wow, destiny has put me here and destiny is pushing me towards that.
Mm-hmm.
Because me growing up, I've always had this feeling of a sense of destiny. Like certain things have happened because destiny has chosen that to happen.
Yeah.
You know, I believe, again, when I'm reading right now, like, for example, Napoleon, he was a great example. In his teenage years, 18, 19 to 22, he always talks about destiny.
Yeah.
He goes, my life, destiny, I will achieve life, greatness.
I'm destined to do
things. Destined to do things, yeah.
I feel like, no. I don't believe in destiny.
You don't believe in destiny?
Yeah. I don't think I believe in the, what's the word? The typical, the, what's that English word that they use? The typical, like, the normal, the usual, like the con,
like, what is it?
Conventional.
Like, conventional, okay.
I don't think I believe in the conventional idea of destiny, which I think usually destiny is associated with determinism. So yeah, things are determined.
Yeah, you're right.
This is going to happen.
Completely agree.
This is your destiny. Whatever means you try to avoid it, that is going to happen. That is your end. I don't think I believe in that notion of destiny. Mm. I think I believe that people have things that they ought to reach in their lives.
Yeah, I think you're right. Destiny, in some essence, is in hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very difficult in the present moment to conceptualize your destiny.
Yeah.
But say some time has gone past, then you look back, then you
can say,
that was destiny.
Yeah, but
so I think it's a hindsight thing, perhaps.
Yeah,
maybe.
Which is why I say I don't think I believe in the conventional idea of destiny. I think it's just whatever's going to happen is going to happen because that's what was supposed to happen for you because that's what you wanted for yourself. I think destiny comes from what you want from yourself, and what you want from yourself is an amalgamation of nature and nurture, if that makes sense. Like, wherever you grow up, that's what creates you. That's what molds your mind. That's what creates your interests.
Do you not believe then, I guess this is a bit of a abstract turn of conversation, but
yeah.
Do you believe destiny and love?
Destiny and love?
Yeah. Where you say you fall in love with someone that was destined to meet that person?
Absolutely not.
I'm serious.
Like, the concept of love.
I believe in that.
I know you probably do.
Yeah,
and 100%. It's like, I'm probably like the biggest fierce hater when it comes to love. I did an episode on this before. Even the concept of love, I don't know if it's, I'm just a big fat hater. Just like, no.
And what's your reason? What is it about love that to you?
I think, I don't think you're destined to meet anyone. I think you will, I don't know how to explain it. You just meet someone who understands you a lot and very much, and I don't think that's anything to do with destiny. I think it's just about, like,
so do you getting love to know. Is just understanding
yeah,
between
it's
two
definitely
people?
100%. So 100%. I think it's genuinely, love is more about understanding, and then understanding to the degree to which you're ready to give up something of yourself and give that to that person and receive the other person as well. I definitely think it's understanding. I don't think there's anything deeper in terms of love, and all that understanding becomes other things. People deepen their relationships in terms of religion, for example, and it's like, that's a mutual understanding of, this is something that we're both working on in terms of religion. And then, like, I don't know, other aspects, like familial relationships as well. Like, you understand me, where I come from, you understand who I want to be, and you are happy, not happy, but you're happy to accept who I was, and whether you like the me who was in the past or not. And you're also happy to take the journey with me for the rest of my life.
Do you believe in God?
I believe in God.
Do you think God's love for you is just, he understands you, that's it?
Yeah.
Or do you think it's nothing more than that?
Yeah. I think God's love is an understanding love. But obviously, I'm still on my walk with religion. So I'm not going to sit here and tell people what God's love is before they come for me in the comments and say, no, you're wrong, you don't know. Because a lot of people, when it comes to religion,
you're admitting humility.
Very judgmental, yeah.
But I think
so I just want to make
when
that
you
clear.
Believe in God, it's almost a given. You have to believe in love as well, because God is something that's not, you can't see, you can't feel, you can't touch. Sorry.
No, let me let you finish. I interrupted you.
I said God is something that you can't see, you can't touch. Yeah. You have to have faith and belief in order to become to believe in God. You can't know God and believe at the same time. There's two different things. So God is a matter of belief. And same with love. You can't touch love, you can't hold it, look at it, recognize it. Yeah. Love is a matter of belief. So I believe if you are someone who believes in love, then love is a real thing. So in right now, it's not that you, through reason, you're like, I logically think love isn't real. Because that doesn't make, it's not,
it's a contradiction.
It's a contradiction. So love is,
Should I explain why?
The benefit is, if you say, I believe in love, I think love becomes an option and an access to. It's just the same way if someone goes, do you know what, I'm open to the belief of God, God can now become an option. So I think belief about, so the way you access love is through belief.
Yeah.
If you see the trail of thinking.
Feel like in my mind, the belief in God and God's love is different. To a love in a relationship. I think that's where the distinction is. That's why I can say what I'm saying about love.
I can agree with you on that notion, because I guess God's love for you is unconditional.
But they call it agapeic love.
Agapeic, wow, nice.
That's the English.
Yeah.
And then the love that you have with a partner, what do they call that one now?
That's conditional love for sure.
I'm not gonna say conditional specifically, but like, you know, there's platonic love between friends, and then there's romantic love. That's like, I don't know why it was hard for me to find that word, but it's romantic love that you have for your partner. And I just feel like that love is just it's just a lot different to the love that God has for us. So I absolutely believe in the love that God has for us. But when it comes to because remember this conversation came out of like destiny. Do you believe in that, like, true love and you're destined to be with someone? No. And I sound like a big fat hater, but I don't. I think all you have to do is build a comfortable understanding with someone, because I genuinely believe that anybody, pick one.
Well, there's a book I really suggest you read. It's Plato's Symposium on Love.
When I read it, I'm going to come back to you.
It's so beautiful, this book. And all it is just a bunch of, ancient Greek, Greece, and it's just seven men around a table, and they all say, okay, we're going to take turns in giving a speech on what we think love is. And at the very end,
they love a cheeky definition.
They love it. Because it's their praise of love. And how the Greeks believed, if you do a great speech about something, that's you showing your praise and love for it. It's the same way how nowadays, if we love an athlete or a rapper, what do? Put them on our wallpapers, a post on our room. For the Greeks, it's to speak about it. And it goes back to that concept of, should we fear death? I believe you should fear death if you believe no one will speak your name after your death.
I keep interrupting you, but no, that's okay. Please tell me to stop interrupting when I interrupt. But do you know what it is? I think it's a thing where, look at all the, for example, Caesar, the time that, because I know you love a cheeky bit of him.
Yeah, I love Caesar.
Would you call it Napoleon as well? Think about them. I don't know if they lived at the same time.
Or Caesar was ancient Rome. Napoleon was 250 years ago.
250 years ago.
Yeah.
So he was here recently.
Yeah, 18th century. Yeah.
So like, he was just here.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
I genuinely thought he was here like in the 1300s.
No.
Okay, anyway. When you think about those two people and the period of time that they were living in, there were thousands, millions of other people who lived exactly at the same time as them. Where are they? And it's like, how significant do you have to be to make such a huge mark?
It's a great point.
Do you know what I mean? In history, like they did.
But I don't think you got anything to lose by trying.
Nah.
And if you think about, I'm not saying you have to be a significant person like Caesar or Napoleon, but because that is extreme
greatness. Then you're nothing.
No, but I think arts is a way of that.
Okay.
Arts is a way. Think about great artists like Vincent van Gogh, for example. This guy was just one random guy in the Netherlands who was full of poverty, lonely, walking around big fields, sitting there just painting. If me and you was to walk down to the our local country park and see one guy painting the trees, and I say to you, oh yeah, this guy will go on to be remembered for hundreds of years, what would you look at me as? Really, what's the likelihood of that? So arts is a great means of that. Another guy, Franz Kafka, a guy who grew up pretty much a nobody in everyday society. And look at him today. You go to Germany, statues of Kafka now. People on TikTok are reading all his books. So I think arts is the I believe art is the best way to get over the fear of death, because once you die, your art will still be here. Van Gogh said one of the greatest, having children is a way of prolonging your legacy, right? That's one of the beautiful thing about having a family. And Van Gogh sees it as art as well. When you have a child, when you produce art, it's your way of producing a child. Because once you die, your art is there. In other words, it's like taking a box, cutting a little bit of your soul, putting in it, closing and leaving it there. And when you die, people who access your art are opening that box and recognize, getting access to your soul again. I think art is the greatest way to prolong your soul. And that's why, and I would say to my friends, what the most devastating thing I'm sure that will make the world cry is if, say, the Louvre or a great museum got destroyed.
Okay.
Why does this concept, why would that make people sad? It's because you will never get that back.
Yeah.
And you will never get that access into Da Vinci again, and access into Michelangelo, and access into Van Gogh. So art, I believe, is the greatest way to get over your fear of death, in my opinion.
Okay. What I'm going to say is very, very reductionist.
Yeah, I love it. Let's go.
And I want to say it because, like, why not? Straw man fallacy. So are you saying everyone should draw?
No. Absolutely
okay,
not.
Just
because art isn't just a thing where you can pick up paper and do this.
Yeah.
But art, I'll give you a microcosm.
Mm-hmm.
Why, you know, when you as a kid, you draw pictures on a thing. Why do some parents keep...
So that they can...
Because it's access to back when you was a child again.
Yeah.
And I think and that is a small example.
Memory.
It's a treasured memory, exactly.
Yeah.
And but what was that? The reductive statement you just made?
Should everyone just draw?
No. You should. No. That's not the case
at all. That's not
the case. It isn't just saying draw a picture and be remembered. Because that's a good point you make. It is reductive, but it's a very good point.
So
it's
just
a great.
Like, just
it's a great
point.
I think if there's something you have about your... I can only speak for me.
Mm-hmm.
My dream is to become a great writer, a novelist. I want to write my own philosophical books. I'm 24 now. I'm young. I believe to be a great artist, you need to be older in age. Because I read something beautiful once. It said, young people, we are amateurs at everything. So how can I produce my philosophy of life at a young age? I think there's some rare examples in the world of literature and philosophy. They've done that. So John Keats was an example. Rimbaud was an example. Yeah.
Can I just disagree?
Yeah, of course.
I feel like I understand what you mean, and that's true in probably majority of cases. The statement that you made that you have to be older to basically talk about life. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah, I agree.
I don't think it's about age. I think it's about experience. And you probably will. Do you agree with that? Okay.
No, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Please, I think it's about experience.
Please.
I think the reason why older people are wiser is because they've just experienced more. But I do believe that it's possible for younger people to go through so much that
at this point you can
definitely write about life because you've just had the experience.
Mm.
So for me, it's definitely not all the time. Like for me, I feel like I've been through stuff, but like it's not that serious. Like it can't ever be that deep. I've definitely been through stuff. But where I am right now, I'm not gonna write a book and say, yeah, this is life. Like, I've been through this, I've been through that now. But I feel like people my age have definitely been through so much that they can write about and genuinely give people advice and feedback on like just life in general.
I completely agree with you,
yeah.
And it's not much for me to say, but one thing that's inspired me, again, the theme you're going to keep seeing here is Van Gogh. I think he's my greatest artistic hero.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that famous paint, The Starry Night?
Yeah.
Everyone knows
that.
I even just said it to you, whoever's listening and you, you just imagine the blues, the
swirls. And the swirls and the
yellow. He painted that in 1890.
Yeah.
But in his letters from 1882, so 8 years, he was always talking about, he goes to his brother Theo, that's all the letters, I want to paint The Starry Night. I want to do it. I'm going to do it. It's 5 years go later. He still hasn't done it.
Yeah.
But when he eventually does it, because it's been brewing and cultivating his mind, that painting isn't just one painting. It's a culmination of an 8-year process of him imagining, building it. And that's how I feel like I'm with my own writings and novels. I can easily just start now and write. But I want to let it brew and mold and get better. And I think to be a great artist, you need to... one of the best lines ever. It said, to understand the history of art, you need to have a history of reading. So I need to read other artists. I'm reading your Tolstoys, Dostoevsky's, Alexander Dumas and Kafka's. To steal, not steal, to to take what I really like from
inspire.
Them.
Inspire.
Yeah, and synthesize it into my own artwork. Mm-hmm. Right now, every time I read a new novel, I'm like, if I would have started a novel then, now, and haven't read this, my novel would have been way worse. So I want to build
Do
up an experience.
Do you know what that makes me think of? Have you read Nietzsche?
Oh, I love Nietzsche so much. Oh, I could go on about him all day if you want me to.
Because the thing is, we're just about to start going on about him.
Cool, let's do it.
Don't do too much though, but we're going to start talking about him. I think the issue with a lot of his writings over time apparently got better.
Mm-hmm.
So what you just said made me think about that. He went back on a lot of the statements that he made in his earlier books, as opposed to the books that he like wrote towards it. I think his last book was...
Last book, Zarathustra.
Absolutely. Good. So we're on the same page. I just want to lean into Nietzsche for a second, because the question is, should we fear death? And it, like, when we look at his writings and the stuff that he has to say, what do you think he would say?
Okay, what Nietzsche says about... Okay, so you want to talk about death, or like basically the existence and meaning at this point? Because I think you can't talk about meaning and existence. You can't talk about death without mentioning those two.
Absolutely. Let's talk about it.
So Nietzsche basically says that... Have you heard of the concept of the Übermensch?
Yeah.
So the overman, the strong man, okay? So he basically...
Superman.
So he's just basically a man who doesn't follow conventions or norms of the herd and the masses.
What is it called?
Herd morality.
It's called herd morality, but he calls that that way of life. He calls it something beginning with A.
A.
And the thing is, I have to remember it now, otherwise I'm going to...
Is it a German word?
Episode. No, it's I don't know what language it's in, because I wouldn't even say it's English. It's a he calls it, it's a way of life. Nietzsche.
Nietzsche. Herd morality word.
A way of life. Like, it's a specific way of life that he refers to that describes, the Christian way of living.
Yeah, I'm sure it's herd morality. He calls it herd morality.
Something else.
Yeah, he has a huge critique of Christian ideas and Christianity.
If it doesn't come up, I'll let it go.
His whole breakdown on Christian morality, it is one of the most unique things I've ever read, because it is got a lot of truth to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe it is very... it can be quite cynical as well, because he grew up working within churches and stuff. So I think he had some personal resentment towards it. But he was essentially saying Christian morality is basically whatever is deemed... In the Roman Empire, how their social hierarchy was created is that the strongest are at the top and the weakest are at the bottom.
Yes,
and he says that Christianity was built out of a slave religion. It's a slave morality. So, but yeah, inverted the power structure. So the Romans who were good, the Romans who were strong were bad people now, morally bad. Uh-huh. And all the slaves who were weak and meek,
they became
good. Yeah. So basically, so I always say it like this. So think about the structure as vertical.
Mm-hmm.
He says the Christians made it horizontal.
Okay,
so good and bad instead of strong and weak. And he said...
Ooh, that's a good way to think about it.
Yeah, so he just flipped it horizontally. And but he says why Christian morality is so powerful is because the figure of Christ himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he says if you want to be Christ, you're going to live a rubbish life. And he was very much... Nietzsche's philosophy was very much inspired by Machiavellian philosophy as well.
Do you know what it is? I think this is why people say that religion is just actually just politics.
Oh, No. It's not. Religion is transcendent. Because religion says you should live by your soul and not by the body. That is transcendent living. Politics is a matter of bureaucracy, ideology.
Yeah,
religion is transcendent.
Is that not what he was describing there?
So he's talking about the bureaucratic element of religion and the structures and the facade of we're pretending we're good, but really we're maneuvering. Nietzsche does not... He's not a guy who hates Christianity. He likes Christ.
He says,
Christian is someone who is like Christ, not someone who's like Paul, Apostle Tom, Apostle John, John, or all these kind of guys, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a very big critique. And it's the same with Martin Luther in the Reformation period. He said, look at the Catholic Church. And you know the 95 theses he knocked on the door, which caused the whole Christian Reformation. He said, look at the Catholic Church. It's turned into this indulgent Roman Empire-esque extravagance, mm-hmm. when the whole teachings of Christianity is about the life of Christ and how to become the soul of Christ. And that's why religion is transcendent, because you're taught to live by your soul and not by your body. Your body is very animalistic, because it has instincts and desires and animal nature for sex, for food, for lust, for laziness, for violence. And if you live by the desires of your body, you're going to live a sinful life. That's why in Christianity, you're a born sinner, because you're a born animal and you're going to have instincts and desires that will lead to your downfall. But what Christianity says, if you live by the little thing inside of your body called the soul and ignore the pleasures of the body, that's how you reach enlightenment. That's how you reach God. That's how you reach salvation. So, and sorry.
Just to explain where I'm coming from, I think what you're saying is right, but I think what you're describing, this is my opinion, is ethics rather than religion. I think that, not that I'm not religious, so
Neither am I, by the way.
I think that religion can be weaponized, or originally
Originally.
It's a political weapon, yeah, because like what Nietzsche was basically describing for me is like, in order to bring down the political structure of society, you need to make it religious, if that makes sense. So initially, as you said, the strong were at the top until suddenly now they're unethical. And that allows you to flip the script.
Yeah, but it didn't happen just within 2 year period or 3 year.
Absolutely.
This took hundreds of years in the Roman Empire time. But you're right. But yeah, sorry to interrupt you, but you're right, because he calls that resentment culture. Yeah. And we can find that same structure. Well, this same structure, so a lot of, I forgot who said, I think it was Nietzsche, someone called communism rotten Christianity. Because if you look at Christianity, what we said,
I think it was Nietzsche.
But he said communism is rotten Christianity. Because if you think about it, please remind me to mention why Plato set the soil to allow Christianity to grow. Okay, if you look at what we just said, Christianity was about making the strong the bad and the weak the good. And this is the same concept in communism. How the strong, the rich, the strong are the bad, and the poor, who are the weak, are the good people. And it's the same, I think, in our modern day society, where we look at the world in Europe and say the white people at the top are the strong, they're the strong, they're the ruling class, therefore they're the bad. And everyone down below that isn't in that category of white is bad. So this good. Concept of resentment.
Did you mean as bad or as good?
Is good, sorry, yeah, now okay. is good. So this resentment culture is always finding itself in every political... I mean, same with the radical feminist movement. The men are the strong, therefore they're the bad. And the women who are the weak are the good. So resentment is basically... Resentment clothes itself in freedom. Because I always say, someone can say the richer this, the richer that. If I was to give you £50,000 or a million, I guarantee you your ideas will change.
Yeah.
Because that resentment is being, basically what Nietzsche says, is a jealousy that they're in the power and we really want to be there.
Yeah.
So in history, what you'll see is the script flip again. And the French Revolution is a fantastic example of.
Historical material.
Historical material, yeah, exactly. Yeah, see the little cherry on top right there.
Just had to add my own 2 pence. But I think the reason why I even started talking about Nietzsche, I hate saying his name.
Yeah,
I don't know.
You know, Americans call him Nietzsche. Yeah, Nietzsche. Sorry. Yeah, Americans call him Nietzsche, and I think how you meant to say it is Nietzsche, but Nietzsche. I call him Nietzsche. I don't even care.
Are you still call him Nietzsche?
Nietzsche.
And it's really wrong of me to do that, but like that's how I see it. I see it as Nietzsche. But I had to act right for the episode. Hence, I said Nietzsche.
Yeah, but you're still right. I know who you're talking about. I'm sure they'll know who you're talking about.
Like, okay, cool. Like, you're just going to have to hold it as it is. but the reason why I even brought him up was because his claim that God is dead and we have killed him.
Oh, yeah. Very, very,
such
very.
Such a good, like, right?
I'll add one more imagery on top of that. He said, you know, like the horizon in a sky.
Mm-hmm.
He said that was, you know, when you're at the beach and you see the horizon and we can imagine that to be God. God is this one big horizon that he says how it goes, what the West have done has, they got a rubber and wiped the horizon away. What a line. Like, God is dead and we've wiped the horizon away. It's just a line. So when I'm at the beach, I just do this.
Wipe away.
Yeah, like this.
Sometimes I think, is he really a philosopher or like.
So Nietzsche's people misconceive
he's
such
that. A good writer.
Oh, his writings are. When people say, "Well, who's your favorite writer?" and I love literature and poetry, mm-hmm. but there's something about Nietzsche's writings. They're like this. Each sentence is like a dagger. He mm. sharpens it.
Yeah.
You read it, and he's like this, and he throws it at you, the mm. reader. And you're like, what did yeah, I just that's, read?
Yeah, he intentionally made his writing so provocative.
Intoxicating. Yeah. But his writings are so similar to Schopenhauer's writings. I read Nietzsche read before Schopenhauer. So when I went to Schopenhauer, I was like, I see where he's getting this from. But Schopenhauer was very much like that. Yeah. He's very honest, very brutal in his words, his imagery. Like, I think that one video I done, he goes, there's no such thing as happiness. It's just pain removed.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's almost Nietzschean kind of imagery. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But the Germans tend to be like that. And why German philosophers are the best philosophers is because they're brave with their writing.
Can I say that? Can I just, I think that's even just, you can, I agree when you say that in terms of like the nation of Germany, but I also feel like time-wise, these days, people are just too scared to say what they really think. People are just too scared to say...
Absolutely.
What, like, just say what you think.
Because they're hurt.
Wait for... Like, not even... Like, just say what you think, however you think it is. And I feel like the problem is, in response to that, people hear things that is different to what they're usually used to hearing, and then they attack it. You're wrong.
For sure.
You can't think that. Who do you think you are? And then the comments that they usually like to run under my comments is... Oh, put the mics away.
Oh, yeah, that's so, a common like, one. I'll give you an example of that. A good example is, as a teacher, I've noticed that year sevens, a lot of big characters come in year seven. Big personalities. By year 10, they've lost it. Because you're in the class, you've got a big personality, and all the other students look at them like...
At you like, no, you can't do that.
You can't be like that. They you want to bring you down.
Exactly, and I think that's why I'm still posting. Because
you have to.
I absolutely do have outrageous ideas, but... Like, most of the things that we do say, philosophers do say, is genuinely just interrogating
it's
stuff.
It's courage.
We're just questioning things and discussing things. We're not necessarily saying this is the right answer. That's the point of philosophy.
Yes, exactly.
You're looking
you're
for the
dogmatic.
Answer. Exactly. And you're not saying this is true, this is the right answer. Even though some, when it comes to ethics,
it's
of course...
It's a thought-provoking... And if people comment, it is thought-provoking.
Exactly. And that's my... That's,
how many people swipe past and they that's don't even comment, even to look at it? And they see yours and they go...
Yeah,
have to comment
now you feel
job
something.
Done.
We need to, because I feel like we just need to start having genuine and proper conversations about everything, but on a deeper level. Because a lot of conversations that we have are just so superficial.
So superficial.
But anyway.
But also, this is a link to British culture as well. British culture is very much stay in line. It's very get back in. Who do you think you are to say? Who are you? What's your expertise?
Mm.
But we've lost the idea that someone... See, with... institution, university, education system is turned into this. You cannot be deemed educated unless you've been educated. But we forgot the concept that so many great thinkers and ideas and even mathematicians and philosophers and writers, painters even, some of the greatest minds have taught themselves.
Yeah.
And that's the best way to learn.
Yeah.
Because in an institution, so when you meet people who study philosophy, they're concept of philosophy is what's given to them, not what they found by themselves.
Oh my gosh, literally. I think about it because I study philosophy, and sometimes it's like, what do I actually think? Because I'm learning a specific curriculum, I'm learning a specific specification. I'm not going, I think you're right. You're literally, all I need to do is go out and read the books for myself.
That's
and see
it.
What I think about them.
People say, oh, where can I go to learn Plato?
Go read.
Oh, read Plato.
The report is there. Like, I literally go and read
it. You know what it is? You're again, right. It goes back to the same theme. It's courage. It's bravery. Mm-hmm. I say people read Nietzsche. Oh, I don't know if I'm clever.
Yeah, just read it, bro.
Read it. Just read it. Read the primary text.
Yeah.
And then learn, then read secondaries after. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying about the German philosophers. Mm-hmm. They're so brave with their ideas. They're so courageous. They will say, like Freud example is another one. The German mindset is brave.
Sorry, you just reminded me of something that I really want to say, because I was other day I was saying to my friends that like a lot of the people who were writing back then, like Freud, literally Nietzsche, literally Schopenhauer, all of them, especially Kant, actually
Hegel, Heidegger, there's just so many Germans.
Like, you can literally just name every single one of them.
Mm-hmm.
All of the philosophers who wrote back in the day would be cancelled.
Oh, for sure.
Today.
For sure.
And it's like, that's just so interesting. This concept of cancel culture is like, is very detrimental to intellectual conversation.
Because we live in a postmodernist world now, mm-hmm. where no one is allowed, anyone who seems like they're speaking as if they have the truth,
yeah.
they get the axe and they start a revolution it's against that person. Well. Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyone who speaks with conviction about something they love or mm-hmm. they believe is true
yeah.
is a way of,
this that goes against the grain.
Grow against the grain. Mm-hmm. And it's also seen as, who do they think they yeah. are to have that power?
Yeah.
And knowledge is the most intimidating thing someone yeah. can have. When you meet someone very knowledgeable, you can almost stutter. I've met some people, super intelligent older men.
Yeah.
And I'm shy. I don't even know what to
yeah.
say. I'm like,
but when
I, yeah, but if I meet a guy who knows how to fight, it's not the same intimidation as someone yeah. with knowledge. But people, young people nowadays, especially in our age, how old are you again? 20. Oh, 20. Yeah, 24. Same yeah. age range. In our generation, people have this mindset of, I will only gain knowledge if it can make me money.
Yeah.
This Ooh. Is creating a world of more ignorance. Is it dangerous?
You're so right. Yeah. No, because you're saying stuff and it's like, this is stuff that I've been trying to say, but I can't put it into words. Yeah. And that's literally what, that's it's literally very what I've dangerous. Been trying to say for a long time.
Because I've met people like Riyadh. I like that you know this, but,
yeah,
but what are you doing with this? I'm thinking,
that's how guys are always coming for my degree. Oh, yeah, you're studying philosophy, but what are you going to do with that? It's not about that.
Nah.
It's deeper. It's just deeper.
No, I don't like to say philosophy is deep. It's elevated.
Mm.
Like, it's an Fair elevated then. Thought. Because philosophy, it raises well. You,
yeah.
and you get to look at things like from a bird's eye view, okay, mm-hmm. I can see how this connects to this. Yeah. Oh my God, this is similar to this. Deep means, in my perspective, it's like a bottom-up top.
Yeah. Yeah.
Philosophy is elevating. And that's why in Plato, and I say Plato is the greatest, because he talks about something called the divided line.
Mm-hmm.
You have, imagine this, 1, 2, 3, 4. Three line. You know a line going across. It goes, the bottom is ignorance. The middle is spirituality, mm-hmm. belief, and at the top is knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And what philosophy does, it raises you from ignorance into belief, so either belief in something mm-hmm. or belief in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And after belief, after knowing what isn't right and what is wrong,
yeah.
you can ascend into knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he breaks down the human soul. We have a bronze soul,
mm-hmm.
materialists, you know, the lower self, kind of Christian idea of being a slave to your body. The middle soul is silver.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, a lot of people have a silver soul. They're courageous, they're brave, they're spiritual, they're very loving and caring,
mm-hmm.
but they're still not the gold soul,
yeah.
the guy who's reasonable, he can think logically. If something's not right, he doesn't hold on to it anymore. He can let go of it.
Mm-hmm.
Plato is by far the greatest philosopher, for sure.
I feel like you've said this so many times about like three different people in one episode.
Did I?
Yeah.
You know, it's for all different reasons.
Yeah, no.
Because you've got a member of Nietzsche. Nietzsche yeah. is trying to be like Plato.
Mm-hmm.
What Nietzsche tried to do is a reevaluation of all values.
Yeah.
So he looked at what the morality of the time, what the norms and the values and the conventions mm-hmm. were, and was trying to reevaluate to install his new own ones. And it's exactly what Plato done in ancient Greek society.
Okay.
Because before Plato, the Greek society followed the Homeric religion
yeah.
of Homer, the Iliad, the Odyssey. So the two main heroes of ancient Greek society were Achilles and Odysseus.
Yeah.
Achilles for young men was a good hero because the ancient Greek young men were like this. I will grow up to be like Achilles, strong, powerful, fit, mm-hmm. athletic. If there's a problem with me, I'll slash them down.
Mm-hmm.
But then Homer realized this is a bit of a problem because we can't have young men growing up to be like Achilles. So Odysseus was mm-hmm. the next story. Cunning, deceptive, clever, manipulative.
Yeah.
And then Plato goes, look at this. So now this is the values at the time. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now Plato is reevaluating these values by saying, young men shouldn't look up to Achilles. Young men shouldn't look up to Odysseus.
Yeah.
I'm going to give them a new hero, Socrates.
Mm-hmm.
A man who, young men can grow up to be like Socrates. A reasonable man who thinks, he's nice. When you read The Republic, Socrates doesn't destroy you, insults you. He's very reasonable.
Yeah.
Now, how does this relate to Nietzsche? Nietzsche's done the same. He critiqued Christ.
Yep.
He critiqued other heroes like other philosophers. And who did he try to give as a new hero?
Yeah.
Zarathustra.
Yeah.
Zarathustra was Nietzsche's way of trying to create a new Socrates.
Mm-hmm.
So Nietzsche is amazing, but he's very intellectually jealous of Plato. 100%. And
that
if you want
such a beautiful sentence.
But if you want proof of What makes someone a great thinker or philosopher? Look at their students. Who was Plato's student?
Aristotle.
Arguably, probably the second greatest philosopher ever, you know? And who is Aristotle's student?
I can't even tell you.
Alexander the Great.
I haven't read that far.
Oh, like, Aristotle, one of my favourite paintings. Have you ever seen the School of Athens painting? Mm-hmm. And I'll show you it quickly. And I'll show it to
Wait,
the camera.
Describe it.
So it's in the Vatican in Rome. And it's basically Raphael was a painter. You know the Ninja Turtles, Raphael? It's named after this painter.
Oh, that's cool.
Did you know that? The Ninja Turtles are named after Leonardo, after Da Vinci. Oh, my gosh. Donatello, named after Donatello. Oh, Raphael, after Raphael. Michelangelo, after... Yep. I thought that's it. Well, cool. This is the painting,
I didn't need that.
This is basically the School of Athens.
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, cool. I've seen it. I'll put it up on the thingy so that they can see the image.
So you see this image here. On the left, this is Plato. On the right is Aristotle.
Yeah.
This is one of the greatest depictions ever of philosophy.
Yeah.
Plato is wearing purple and red because Plato's philosophy is metaphysical and very idealistic.
Yeah.
Fire for red. So fire is almost metaphysical. Fire is very alluring, you know. Yeah. It's very... Oh, I can't, because fire has no form.
Yeah.
That's why.
Oh,
and purple for space, because you know the word ether, the dark ether, that comes from Plato. He believed that was the fifth element. But Aristotle is wearing brown and blue, and Aristotle's doing this.
Yep.
He's a scientific thinker.
Empiricism.
Blue for the waters, brown for the earth.
Ooh.
And now, when they do, one's looking up. So these, what I say, this picture defines the history of philosophy. You've got two branches. The metaphysicians and the religious thinkers.
Rationalism.
And
empiricism.
And the British were the empiricists.
Yep.
Pragmatic. What works?
Have you
what
read Hume?
I've only read one paper by Hume, and it's called the On Suicide.
Ooh,
and he was trying to assess if suicide is a rational or irrational thing.
Ooh.
And he said, and he used one argument I really liked, and I actually compared it to abortion.
Yeah.
He said in this essay, he goes, people say suicide goes against nature.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes, if your child was drowning in the river, would you save the child, or would you say nature's doing its course?
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same with abortion, and it got abortion when it goes, abortion goes against nature.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the argument you're going to go, if someone's drowning or in a fire, would you then go, no, I won't save them. I won't intervene in nature's process. I'll allow nature to do what it needs to do. In other words, the whole point of human nature is that we...
allow nature to take
Or we manipulate nature. But let's not get too deep in this concept.
Okay, because you did just lose me there, but
we can't
leave that.
Sorry.
Okay, do you know what I realised? We have not even answered the question.
Should we fear death? You should.
No, we don't even... need to answer the question. I feel like the conversation has been like really beautiful as it is. I forgot what I was gonna say, so I'm just gonna bring it
so
up.
I just waffled so much for a second.
No, you didn't even waffle, because like a lot of it is relevant things. Like,
oh, for
what
sure.
We spoke about was relevant and important things to talk about anyway. And the question is really just a sentence starter.
To see can I ask you a question?
Yes, you can, please.
What do you think of when you have a child, would you let them listen to the current music in today's world?
I feel like I'll just let my child do whatever they choose.
So would you... So yeah, actually, let me ask you, Becca, would you ever intervene in your child's cultural interests?
Yeah.
So what... Say if they're born today. Say they're 7 years old today.
Yeah.
How would you, as a parent, go about things with TikTok, social media, music, culture?
Oh,
where would
you
push their interests?
I don't think I'll push their interest towards something. I would definitely push it away from something.
Oh, wow.
So in terms of... That's my truth.
That's a nice one.
Because especially because I'm looking at my sister. I have a younger sister. And the way my parents have like worked on her, she doesn't have a phone still. She's in year 8.
Mm.
She doesn't have a phone. And I was saying this the other day. What I realised is she hasn't had a phone since, and she doesn't have a phone now, but she has a phone, but she doesn't have social media right now. She doesn't have TikTok. She's not allowed to have Instagram. Not that she's not allowed, but she like is strongly advised that not right now. Because I got Snapchat in year 11, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I started doing social media properly, like literally. I deleted it
when
for
you're
2 years.
When you're a bit more mature.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
That's just how I... And the thing is, no one forced me to do that. That's just how I decided to live. But it was heavily influenced by my parents. But anyway, what I realised is she can play the piano. She can play the ukulele.
Beautiful.
She can play the cello. She's incredible at art. She's very good at reading.
Wow.
And her maths is incredible.
And do you think social media could... undo that a little bit?
Not that it can undo it. It will stop the process. Because when children are introduced to things like quick 30-second video, that's all they're going to do is quick. It's fun. It's there's light. It's bright. Children, they like that's why Cocomelon is so popular. They like bright things. They like songs. Yeah, they like stuff like that. And it's like, the TV shows that used to be on CBeebies were good because they were educational, for example. And they were also just, this is a 30-minute video now. After that, the video that comes after is, good night, son. Time to go to sleep at 7 p.m.
It's dopamine stuff now, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, exactly. Now it's all just for, like, it's capitalism. Let's be for real. Just so that, because they know that the children want this. This is what they're going to promote. This is what the parents are going to buy. But let me get back to the point that I was making, which is that my sister is very multifaceted and she's very, very, very talented when it comes to reading and things of that nature.
Phenomenal.
And that is because she has not been distracted by things like TikTok and social media. That is not to say that I'm going to tell people how to parent their kids. But what I will say is reason why the likes of, I don't know, you know all the incredible composers, they didn't have TikTok.
Yeah. Oh.
Do you know what they did have?
I completely agree with you.
They had time.
Either
and way. What stops people from really flourishing when it comes to things like TikTok? Scroll, you think you will scroll one, 3 hours have gone by.
Can I give you a little concept I have about the TikTok scrolling?
Please do.
So you know on TikTok, there'll be loads of little accounts that are just posting clips.
Yeah.
And also, you know they make money from these clips.
Yeah, yeah.
I call them the internet drug dealers, okay?
Because this is good.
in real life, a drug dealer,
they
will sell you drugs at your expense. Yeah. So you're the one suffering.
You're gonna buy it.
And I'm making profit off your suffering. Mm-hmm. Now it's just a digital version where I'll make all these accounts, brain rot content.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll sell it, make money off of people's expense.
Mm-hmm.
So I call them internet drug dealers.
Yeah.
And only if they knew that, of course, it's about ethics now. And I'm someone who believes in the consequences of things. Mm-hmm. I can never do things if I know the consequences lead to bad because it goes against my morals and principles. And when you're putting brain rot content out there, yes, you're making money.
Yeah.
But is that doing, is that true justice for the community and the world you grow up in? Of course not. It's not. Yes, exactly. We're on such a great trail of thinking because it goes back to Plato. The first book of the Republic is all about justice.
Mm-hmm.
And they all talk about what is justice.
Mm-hmm.
Socrates beautifully says, justice is this, doing what's best for yourself, not what's most pleasurable for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what for a leader of a city or a country should do. Not what's best for him or his party or the people around him or the elites, but what's most pleasurable on me, but do what's best for everyone.
The community.
And it's the same, I believe, if we had this concept on an individual level, we'll harbour a much better community. Do what's best for each other. What most pleasure.
Mm.
And that's why it's a transcendent way of living. Doing what's best is living by an ideal, and doing what's most pleasurable is living by the body, a material. What did you say earlier? It's a material way of living.
Yeah, I don't know.
But
what
internet drug dealers.
That's so interesting. I like that. Mm. And it's stuff like that that people are going to come and be like, what on earth is he talking about?
No, I let them do
that. And it's just like,
I don't mind.
People, like, that's what I'm saying. It's just that, like, the reason why we have all of the theories that we have today is because people sat down and they actually theorized.
Yeah, absolutely. And but people you said are a so beautiful afraid. Line, though. Time. Such
oh,
a
I'm
beautiful line because it's so
you,
true.
Because
when you read
time.
Nietzsche and Plato, Schopenhauer, you're like,
yeah.
Think about this. They didn't have computers. They would have on their desk books.
And they had time to get through that.
So much
time to write about it. Because they weren't distracted by 30-second clips that would take them down a rabbit hole of scrolling for 30 hours
straight. When you're scrolling next time, I've tried to do this and I realise why TikTok is so powerful or scrolling, okay?
Yeah.
Try and say to yourself, I'm only going to watch 5 more.
Yeah.
By the third one, I promise you won't remember. That's a good way to see how powerful it is. Because I'm like, you know what? 3 more and I'll come
now,
off
TikTok. Now, you know, go to sleep.
1, 2... It never
and
ends.
Then suddenly it's 10, suddenly it's 20. And it's like, if you actually conceptualize how many videos you even get through, like, in your lifetime, it's crazy.
Rot.
Social media is crazy. Like,
what do you think about iPad babies?
I think about them exactly what I think about my sister, like, what I said. You're really, really hindering a child's growth. And the potential... This could be our next generation of serious philosophers, bruv. Do you know what they could come up with? They could probably solve so many, because these kids are so smart, you know, they're so quick. Children in general, they're so smart, they're so quick. They could literally, all you have to do is cultivate the environment that they are in. Give them the paper, give them the pen. That's what they need.
Do you know what children are like? You know when you play chess.com or something and you play against those difficult you're doing it and they make the most simple move and you're like,
why didn't I think of
that? And it's the same truth. I said it before, I'm a teacher. I mean, let's talk about something and they ask me the most simple question.
And it's like, and I'm like, the whole thing.
I don't even,
the lesson's over now.
How do like, I even the, answer that? You know that is mean? Such a good question.
Yeah.
That is such a good, children are beautiful. And one thing that what makes me want to be a teacher is that I just can't conceptualize how curious kids are. They're so passionate, so curious, so inquisitive. But how is it they're like this in year six?
Yeah.
And by year 10, end of the, back of the class like this. I think it's a tragedy. But the school system has to reform. It has to.
Oh my gosh, this, no. There's so much that I could talk about. And I don't want to get into it because I want
to. If there's anywhere in the in your life to get into it, it's here. Who cares what the herd think?
That's so true. What was I going to say? I feel like.
Don't be fazed by the comments.
You're right.
Trust me.
I feel like what it is that, you know, this concept of our like teenagers, they just grow up and they're gonna get grumpy, like puberty type thing. I feel like saying that is what makes people like, you're speaking it into existence.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah. Exactly.
It's the same with children. If I say, you know what some student said to me once, he goes, "Sir, you always give me praise, but I'm meant to be the bad one."
Yeah.
I was like, oh.
Yeah, you've spoken that onto yourself.
I was like, right, like, you believed what they said, you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of adults struggle to. What you said earlier, there's so many things to talk about. What you said earlier is so true. This generation is a great generation for a new generation of philosophers.
Yeah.
Or not philosophers, because philosophers.
Just intellectuals in general. Intellectuals.
Because
when,
as much as you read Plato, as much as you read Nietzsche and all philosophers, one thing you can. That always comes to an end of their thought is. They didn't have social media.
Yeah.
So a lot of their ideas are phenomenal, but it only reaches a certain peak before we need to take the ideas and carry it onto the next level. Because social media has changed everything. So we need, I think we're going to have social media philosophers soon in the next 30, 40 years.
That is literally what I'm waiting for. Yeah, I'm waiting like, for it come too. On, let's like, get to it, like hurry up. And like, the only way that we can get there faster, if like we can even rush the process, is by people forgetting this whole thing about cancel culture, forgetting this whole thing about there's one right idea and everyone has to agree with this idea, otherwise you're wrong. And like, that's a very, very political view.
Cancel culture of just life is so in general. Dangerous.
Very. They have know what they did of, when they introduced it.
Have you ever heard of the philosopher Hannah Arendt?
No, I have, yeah.
She is the most phenomenal philosopher. Oh, watch her interviews on YouTube, if anyone watching, yeah? She'll be sitting there, black and white, cigarette.
She's hard.
I don't consider myself a philosopher. She's so good. But she said something. The greatest human invention, she argues, is the idea of forgiveness. Okay. Because the hardest thing as a human to do is to act, to do something. Mm-hmm. And that connotates bravery and courage as well. Because once we act and do or say something, we can never take it back. And what Shakespeare said, what is done is done. But she said the concept of forgiveness is a way for us to free ourselves from an action. So... in today, these celebrities are people who say things, then they get cancelled. The only way to for them to redeem or repent for some bad action is to be forgiven. But if forgiveness is never an option, they're burdened to live with their fault for the rest of their life. So once society gets rid of the concept of forgiveness, it's very dangerous. And there's been many societies in history where forgiveness is not allowed. Basically, that leads to terror. And, so forgiveness is one of the greatest human inventions. And cancel culture is undermining it. But I think we've moved a little bit past cancel culture now.
I feel like we've moved past posting, "You're cancelled." Like, you know how they used to let specifically say this person is cancelled? We've definitely moved past that, but I don't think the culture's gone. I feel like it's there, but just in a different
format. It's no different to exile or exiling someone or imprisoning them for their thoughts and beliefs. But, like, but just it's just a digital version now.
Unfollow, block, whatever. not liking their content, not engaging with their
content. One thing I do like a lot is, you know how a lot of people are now blocking celebrities to make them lose all their followers?
Oh, is that what people are doing?
Yeah, so Kim Kardashian lost like 3 million followers.
Oh, damn.
Because to stop them, and I think that's a great way of revolting against
a
system.
What did Kim do this time?
I don't know, but it's just a way of, basically, some celebrities are influencers on TikTok and social media. Yeah. They are so useless to society. They offer nothing, like absolutely nothing. This is my skincare routine, guys. This is what I bought from Pretty Little Thing, and they're getting paid thousands upon thousands.
And I don't know if it's the capitalist society, but it's a political plot. They know what they're doing, and I have to attribute it to capitalism, because it's just a way of making money. Dumb down the whole society.
Money's God.
Make
now,
people
isn't
stop
it?
Thinking. Yeah.
If Nietzsche said God is dead and the throne is vacant, the dollar sign has taken its place.
Yeah.
For sure. But this is the Americanization.
That was such a beautiful image that you drew out right there. Absolutely.
Yeah, I've got another image I love. I think who killed God was Immanuel Kant. I believe strongly the man who killed God.
Kant.
Yeah, Immanuel Kant.
You can't just do that. Kant. You can't just
that's
him.
The one name I always get, Immanuel Kant.
No, I'm not saying
that. Sorry. Yeah,
I'm
Immanuel
just saying
Kant.
You can't.
He killed God.
I don't know how to say it.
I always say, if Nietzsche, and I always say this, Immanuel Kant put the bullet through God's head, and Nietzsche found the body later on.
Ooh,
that's how I always like to say it. Or God and or Nietzsche like this. Found him.
Found him.
He's on the floor.
He's dead.
Yeah. He's
dead.
Dead.
And we have killed him.
And that's what people misconceive. Nietzsche didn't kill God. He's announcing
God.
He's announcing. You know, basically like this. You know when you've seen The Simpsons or in real life, the end of days, someone's wearing a cardboard.
Yeah.
That's Nietzsche with the cardboard saying, God is dead. And you have killed him. The greatest crime in Western history is killing God.
What's the game? Among Us.
Among Us.
I have to go find a dead body.
Yeah. And Immanuel Kant is the one. Because Immanuel Kant basically split human experience into two things, phenomena and noumena.
Yeah, and
phenomena is just the process of the external world.
He did too much. You don't need to do all that. Like his whole book, all of the transcendental idea, that's the hardest book I've ever done in my life.
Yeah,
I'm never
going to
read
eventually.
It again. You take time. Take your time.
I'm
you don't need
to
rush at all. It's very rich. In fact, I'm not going to tell you what it is, because maybe you understand it, maybe you don't, but I did not enjoy that at all. Maybe it's the way that I taught it.
But that's normal though.
Maybe
it's
the way
normal.
That I was taught it. But
well, that's so normal. I've watched a lot of great philosophy lectures and they always say the same thing. When they introduce Kant, they always say, okay, guys, it's like eating through metal. You might get some snippets.
Level,
you're like, okay, I'm following.
Yeah,
and
then
you're
suddenly,
like,
you've lost me, sir. Like, you've lost me.
Yeah,
in
Schopenhauer
the first
was a little bit similar at times as well.
I feel like Schopenhauer's writing is just so abstract that you can find
the
it.
Oh,
the thing about Kant is that you're trying to do science here. Nobody asked you to do that.
Yeah.
He's a
product of the Enlightenment period. Mm-hmm. But he goes, human experience is one big cloudy fog. Yeah. There's something we feel, but we never can penetrate this fog and know what's on the other side. Mm-hmm. He goes, basically, behind this fog is the thing in itself. Mm-hmm. Some might call it God, some might call it truth, but essentially, we can never get past it. Mm-hmm. So this world of the poets and religion, all they're doing is describing what they believe this fog is. Mm-hmm. So forever can't reduce God down to this. Since we can never know him, we might as well just keep moving. He done the example of, if we have two societies, one is based on noumenal experience, another society is based on phenomenon. Phenomena will take you to the solar system and noumenal wouldn't be able to invent anything. Mm-hmm. And it's a reasonable argument to make. I was going to say something to you about Schopenhauer. Why Schopenhauer is so unique, mm-hmm. how influenced he was by Eastern philosophy.
Yeah.
But what makes him even greater as an intellectual, he came to conclusions about human experience. Then he read Eastern philosophy and goes,
this matches what I'm saying.
He built it, then found it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But you know the book, it goes world as will and representation.
Beautiful book.
I can explain it in the most simple way. In Hinduism, they say, and this is what he was very inspired by, he said there is one God. Mm-hmm. How God shows itself is different to everyone. Mm-hmm. So it represents itself to different people. If you speak this language, God will show himself in your language.
Yeah,
if you have this cultural and this aesthetic taste, mm-hmm. God will reveal itself to that aesthetic taste. Mm-hmm. So in the Hindu God pantheon, there's one at the top and all these different representations to match different types of people. Mm-hmm. This framework is what Schopenhauer has taken about human society. He says, all human beings, we belong to one single will. Mm-hmm. But how that will represents itself is different through different individuals. Mm-hmm. So me and you, we can have, we both share one will, but how the will decides to represent is different me and you. Mm-hmm. So he said, if someone steals from you with a knife and tries to kill you and steal something, mm-hmm. that is the exact same representation, is the same will as someone who robs a bank. Different representations. Mm. One is with a knife at gunpoint. Okay, one is stealing with a gun in a bank. But it's from the same will.
Yeah.
Represented in two different aspects. So that's, and I believe that. So when we go, why does history always repeat itself? And I think he has the best argument. It's because we all belong to one will. Mm-hmm. And history will always repeat how it represents itself in mm-hmm. different ways. So the French Revolution is very similar to the Russian Revolution. Mm-hmm. In Schopenhauerian terms, it would be they come from the same will. The same will of revolution, but is represented in two different ways. Mm-hmm. But essentially, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
So, I think it's the greatest. It's much. I would argue I'm a Schopenhauerian. I'd view the world through his metaphysics.
Yeah. He had a very interesting theory, and I liked it a lot.
Who's one person you don't like?
Like a philosopher I don't like?
Or a concept, or a viewpoint, or a branch of philosophy
that I don't agree with. I don't know. I can't even think of anything that comes to mind right now.
Mine would be psychology.
Do you think psychology is philosophy?
It's a schism of philosophy. Because Freud basically said there's no such thing as philosophy. If you but what he says is that when you look at philosophy truly, you can't really speak about the philosopher's theory without the philosopher's psychology. So really, the philosopher is imposing his psychology onto the world. Is it some truth in that? There is some truth.
I hear where he's coming from, but he just wants to be relevant. Leave us alone for it.
Absolutely.
Go away.
But psychology is very damaging for...
The study of psychology.
Yeah, because I think it traps man too much in their own head. Whereas I think philosophy liberates you from your head.
Yes. But I just feel like we need different mediums of thought and different mediums of understanding to look at, because do you know something I always ask myself is, like, if I could do a case study, I would really do this. I would go into universities and I will ask one question to different different people studying different courses, and what you will find is an art student will answer, like, what is the human body, for example. They will answer that so differently to a biology student.
That's very true.
He will say the, like, made up of cells. To a chemistry student, he will say it's made up of chemicals. To a psychology student, he will say it's about the mind.
That's a great point you make.
Do you see? And to a sociology student, he will just, I don't know, talk about intersectionality maybe. To a politics student. And I just feel like you need all these different mediums of understanding to really, like, understand
really,
like,
into one person, and that's what them philosophers in the past, they were polymaths, they understood so many different subjects. They knew physics, biology, maths, chemistry.
That's why philosophy is ethics, literally the best. There's a philosophy of everything.
Yeah, but Michel Foucault says that it's a form of power by the state to dissect education into so many different specializations, basically not allowing all of this education in the hands of one person, because only a person who has a lot of education.
Capitalism.
I don't know if it's capitalism. We have to be careful with the word capitalism.
Okay, fair.
Because power and power, indoctrination, propaganda, structures, and hierarchy precede capitalism. So I don't believe the powers that be.
All that stuff was very prominent in communism. Yes, all the attempts at communism, anyway.
Yeah. So remember, the powers that be, or the ruling class,
whatever you want
to
call it.
Yeah, whatever you want to call it. They're not trying to keep capitalism, they're trying to keep power. It doesn't matter if it's capitalism, it doesn't matter if it's this, or war, military, or social media, it's power. And that's why I think Nietzsche's main great idea is the will to power. Everything in politics is about power. Yeah. When you look at the religious wars, is it a war about religion, or is it a war about control of power?
That's what I was saying earlier.
Yeah.
That's what I was saying earlier. A lot of stuff to do with religion, because when it comes to religion, I genuinely feel like religion is for people, not for God. I feel like God is personal. Your relationship with God is personal.
Great.
But religion, it creates that community, but I feel like it's very, very much it's very much a worldly thing. And as a result of it being a worldly thing, it has been used as a weapon. Like, you can see it just across the world, like the way people manufacture the concept of religion, using God's name in vain to say, oh, this is what is right, this is what is wrong, simply for political gain. And by virtue of the political gain, economic gain, because at the end of the day, everyone just wants money. But yeah, power. That's my own view on religion. Not that I'm not religious anyway, but like, you know.
No, this isn't like a set in stone view, because I'm sure that's when you're 25, the view will change when you're 30.
It possibly will.
Yeah,
but that's just how I feel about it right now. That's, you know, that's something that, as you said, I would write about now, might be wrong when I'm older. You know what I mean?
And it will be wrong probably, you know, because you're young.
Because
I promise you, when you're young, I really believe this, when you're young, because it's a new idea, we hold on to it much more, you know?
Oh yeah, because I feel like I'm smart now because I came up with something new.
No.
I don't know what you're trying to say.
I'm just saying, like, I'm guilty of this as well. Mm-hmm. We fall in love with this new idea. We believe it works. But then the best idea is to just...
Wait.
Don't hold it so tight. Because you don't want to look foolish for now having to go back against your work. Because I have journals now that go back 5 years. When I read some of my ideas I was 20, I'm
that
like...
couldn't eat.
Didn't eat nothing. Just starving, homeless.
And that's what's so interesting just about philosophy in general. And people need to stop taking things too seriously sometimes.
I think Wittgenstein was another one who done that. Went back on a lot of his old ideas and reworked them.
He was cool.
Yeah, he was very cool. Wittgenstein's underrated. But he's too technical. You have to be very, not clever, but you have to have some form of intelligence to understand him.
Yeah. But even with, I feel like with the stuff that he says, you have, like, it's too... dogmatic to some degree, like,
so?
Yeah, like, you're too, it's too prescriptive.
He's talking in the world of maths, so it's very principled,
so that's probably
objective.
What it is,
because maths is, people say there's no such thing as objective truths. You just don't know maths. That's what I say. You just don't know maths, because maths is objective truth.
An objective truth is a contradiction.
Think so?
Yeah.
What is maths?
No, because saying objective truth is just, what do you call it? Begins with a T. You know when there's a word, and then you say the word next to the word, and then now it's
a word.
No, it's not. Ah, this is a tautology.
But tautology is something that always equals something, isn't it?
I don't know.
Like 2 + 2 = 4. That equals is tautology. It will always equal 4. So the tautology of something, it will always happen. If I drop this phone, it will always fall. So the tautology is.
That's why I say objective truth is a tautology, because a truth is objective. So why do you have to add objective in front of truth? Because these days people think that truth is subjective. You know when people on social media, that's my truth. And what I think
But when people say that, I really believe subjectivity is a way to mask your intellectuality. If your lack of intellectuality.
Yeah, I agree.
I completely. Because me and you, we can have a debate about art. Mm-hmm. Someone could be so well read, so well versed, mm-hmm. very, very, very well read in art, and they have an opinion or an expert opinion about art. Mm-hmm. But you, not just use an example, mm-hmm. you never read anything, but never really looked at it. But you go, mm-hmm. you're wrong. This is my subjective belief. It undermines truth. It's very dangerous when you do that.
And that's what I think postmodernism is like.
The critique of anything objective truth.
Yeah. And I think that's the problem with the world right now. People are too scared to think that things are just what it is. Like, for example, this is, like, a very trivial thing, but, like, obviously the connotations of being fat, for example, it had, negative connotations because it was often before, in some cultures, associated with being ugly, even in other cultures, being fat is really beautiful. But that's a conversation for another day. I just think, for example, if you say, oh, yeah, that person is fat, or that person has a big head. Oh my gosh, you can't say that. No, you can't say that. That's really rude. It's a fact.
It's creating a sensitive society. You don't want that. History shows.
As you said, what did you call it earlier? An effeminate society.
We live in we are in an effeminate society now. And that's not to say it's bad, but
that's
it
not
is
to say it's fat.
But that's what I'm saying.
People are so quick to say, oh,
and
yeah,
another
this
reason,
is bad, this
right,
is good.
The reason why society is becoming effeminate is because of the lack of the father in the household. So a lot of children are being socialized by just a woman.
Yeah.
So they're growing up with much more female traits. Mm-hmm. And essentially, the welfare state has replaced the father in the household. Because now, say if a woman 20 years, say before the welfare state, got divorced from her husband or her father, father passed away, the incentive is to get another husband, so he comes in a strong male role model in the house and a means of income. But now if a woman's to divorce her husband or her father passes away, there's no incentive for her to go get a new husband or a boyfriend to bring in a man in the house. She can go to universal credit, get a welfare system. So essentially the state is the new father. There's a very, very interesting guy everyone should watch on YouTube and you should. His name is Thomas Sowell, an American economist, and these are his ideas. And I just think it's completely true, because me and my mum had this discussion. When I was 13 years old, my father passed away. And then my mum says to me, "You're right. If I was in the 50s or 60s, I would have had to go out, get a new husband to bring a man in, to bring income in. But that's not just for income. Now it's a man in the house. So the children are socialized by feminine energy and masculine as well, because you need a balance between the two. And I am a binary thinker. I do think the world can be separated into binary options.
Because that's what I was gonna ask. Do you believe? I don't know what the actual specific term is. I've forgotten. But do you believe that men and women are born with specific characteristics?
For sure, yeah. Biology, for sure, yeah.
Do you think it's biological? Yeah. A lot of people don't agree with that.
No, I completely agree with it. I think. Okay, it's a bit metaphysical. I think we both have the same soul, equal soul, no difference in our souls, but how the flesh and bone is created around the soul is different. That's how I agree. Women are, this concept of equality between man and women is so difficult. It's because men are great at some things. Women are also great at some things. But it's just because of material thing. And the money and profession and status is what's made it feel like if we make it equal, we can share the same status. Status is a very, very... it creates resentment. Because if men have got the status, we got the fame, the riches, and the glory in history, it will create resentment on the other side. You get what I mean? So status is what... I'm just talking too much.
Men and women are... Like, this is literally just like the last thing I want to say. Because I just feel like I should say something. Men and women are both... Like, both have... the capacity to have both masculine and feminine traits.
Oh yeah, for sure. I completely agree.
Yeah, so it's difficult then to now say that men are born with masculine traits and then women are born with feminine traits only.
Yeah.
Do you see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think in today's discourse of what is a man, what is a woman,
which is not something that I'm ready to get into.
We never need to get into it. Because I think Marcus Aurelius said it best. Don't tell me what a man is. Show me one. Don't tell me what a woman is. Show me one. That's it.
Or like the idea of being a woman that you want to be.
Just be one. Why talk?
I think all the talk is just very, very unnecessary.
Just be one. Show one.
I'm glad we were able to understand that same point together, because I was scared for a minute that maybe we're going to have to get into a conversation.
No, we won't. Because I think it's as simple as that. Show one. Don't be one. Don't tell me what one is.
Yeah. Exactly. The truth is, like, if I tell you how long we've been here, you might be shocked. How long do you think we've been here for?
You know what? I can't lie. I did see it like 10 minutes ago. I saw an hour. I was like... you're the host, isn't it?
Oh, this is a good time. Only because I'm like very lazy when it comes to editing.
I hear it.
Yeah, so,
I used to do hour and a half ones. I'm like, oh, that's good. You know, I'm like, drag. I get to 45 minutes. Yeah, I'm like,
drag. It's enough.
Another 45 minutes.
Yeah, it's enough now. So that's why for me, I stick.
No, I've really enjoyed myself in this conversation.
Really,
I really liked it. Of course, you're a great host. You're really a
great host. I'm Madame Hardy. I just like philosophy, and I like people who like philosophy. And there's two people here who like philosophy.
I'm sure this won't be the only one we ever do as well.
Maybe. You know, I was gonna say, come back.
Yeah,
you will be back. We'll be having another conversation.
Yeah.
So what I was gonna say to close out the video is, you didn't answer the question. And that's fine. We started off with answering the question. You answered it I had so many other things to say.
So I'll give a closing statement.
A closing statement.
Should we fear death?
I'm surprised you even remember the question.
Yeah, of course. Because
despite everything that we
said. I feel like everything in this episode is braided into each other.
Don't get me wrong. It's not that we just sat here and had just like a chat about absolutely nothing. I think the conversation was gorgeous. It was really good. Gorgeous. Yeah, that's how I want to describe it. That's what I think. But I'm just saying that you didn't answer the question. So you might see the question being answered by someone else.
Should we fear death? Yes. But should we fear if death is coming tomorrow? No.
See, you never said that before.
I'm saying it now.
I know, but I wanted to unpack it. You know, you're buried. He said, yeah, well, I'm saying it now. You're right, but I wanted to unpack that. And now I feel like we don't have time. Just quickly, just like, what do you mean by that?
I mean, we should fear death, of course, because I said it gives you urgency. But should you think it's going to come tomorrow, come tonight?
Mm-hmm.
No, because you're living with it's a grim reaper over your shoulder. Fair. You're literally feeling its breath on your ear. Mm-hmm. That's the worst way to leave.
It's not worth it, living like that.
You should look at death like this. I'll see you when I have to see you. But for now, let me do what I have to do. And every day is that famous quote, carpe diem, seize the day.
Mm-hmm.
When you seize that day, if you seize the day, that's you... You know, throwing a punch at death.
Because,
you know, today is I woke up, I made everything I could out of it. So, this is one step closer to...
Just, like, making something of myself.
Yeah.
Being somebody, basically.
Mm.
Wow. Riyad.
Eden.
You said my name back to me. People don't usually do that. Guys, the truth is, I'm not even going to ask you if you enjoyed the conversation you have to have, because we went everywhere. Like, you literally can't complain.
Your passport's ready, man.
You're very, very intelligent.
Thank you.
I feel like I have to address that point. You're very well read and you're very inspirational because of that. I'm genuinely going to pick up a book because of you and keep making your content. Keep creating the stuff that you're doing. Genuinely, like, literally love it. No, I have to say it, because when it comes to stuff like this on TikTok, people don't really appreciate it well enough. They probably see it and then they scroll past. Do you know what it takes to have to read, like, how many pages is even in that book? You're already on page 100 and something, and there's like 900 pages, and then do a review, an educated, like, conclusion about what you think, and also have an opinion and not be afraid of the opinion that you have. I think you need to keep doing that and, like, forget about everything else that people are doing on social media. It's people like you, it's people like you that genuinely I'm literally searching for, and I found you. Well, you found me, but, like, we found each other. Here we are.
Thank you. I appreciate
that. You will be back. Please drop your social media one more time so that they can follow you.
Oh, the Lyceum of Arts.
Thanks. I'm gonna put it up there and put it in the description. Make sure you like, share, subscribe, all that stuff. I hate saying that because, like, why am I begging? If you want to do it, do it. You know what I mean? But, yeah, we've been here for long enough. I'm going to edit the video now.